Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 114 of season 11 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Joe Muccia, a veteran battlefield tour guide, historian, and podcaster. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thanks, Rob, for having me. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you finding the time to talk to us, because I know you know a lot about Band of Brothers and about everything that's going on around this time. So I'm looking forward to these episodes where we can dive deep into what's really going on as we see these characters dealing with the various situations they're going to have to deal with. So thank you very much.
Always a pleasure to talk about the veterans themselves and this stunning miniseries. It's, again, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. All right. So why don't we start with the first question that I ask everyone that I know you're – this might be a long-winded answer, but that's fine too. Okay. What's your history with Band of Brothers? Like, how are you connected? I mean, again, you can talk about the book. You can talk about the miniseries, everything. I want to hear it all. I'm very interested.
As you stated, I'm a veteran. I'm a United States Marine Corps retired gunnery sergeant. My initial foray into Band of Brothers and understanding Band of Brothers and becoming aware of it was way back when I was a young Lance Corporal. The Commandant of the Marine Corps placed Band of Brothers on the Commandant's reading list. My mother had picked up a copy of it for me. From a young age, she always, you know, promoted reading and bought books for my sister and I, so I was always an avid reader, and I devoured it, and then kind of put it away for a little while, because it was quite a few years before the miniseries came about. Fast forward to 2003, I'm in Kuwait, and obviously the war is looming. When I went over there, I had brought a couple of books in my rucksack, and one of them was Band of Brothers. And on a lark, I decided to write Major Winters, and he responded. And
by email,
after that,
he was responding to emails, or it was
no, this is very little email at
right now. That's what I've heard about Winters, that he, you know, for him, a letter was, you know, a letter, as you know, those of us, those of us before the digital age remember what they are.
So. I was gonna say, you know, the U.S. Armed Forces are starting to be highly digitized at the time. Although when you're in a Marine rifle regiment, infantry regiment, you're at the pointy end of the spear. You don't have a lot of access to computers, right, at that point, unless they're operational computers. So snail mail was very much the thing. So I wrote him, and he wrote me back, and that began a very long relationship between myself and the Easy Company veterans. So my interest in it actually grew from the veterans, not the miniseries. When the miniseries launched, it had launched before we went over there, and I had devoured it as much as possible. And again, that's probably why I, you know, just on a lark wrote him. I figured we're on the eve of battle. What better way to communicate concerns and things of that nature, and glean from somebody else's experiences in that same regard, than to talk to one of the most celebrated officers in the United States military's right, history. But
who
over
was,
time,
who was still around at
more,
the time,
more
also,
the better.
Because again, you're not going to be able to talk to, yes, you know, people who fought in the Civil War and the Revolutionary War and all that stuff. So here you had somebody who has this experience, and you know, as we all know, Dick Winters never minced words by telling his thoughts on everything. So yeah, that is,
yeah, and it from there it just snowballed. Guys like Bill Garnier and Babe Heffron, Don Malarkey, Buck Compton. I could go on and on. The veterans that I was able to speak with right up basically almost until their passing. So I was very privileged with that. But it also started a love affair with the band miniseries, and I got to interact with a lot of the actors over the years as well, and many of them I consider close friends. So to me, it's a little weird when I watch the miniseries now. There's a sense of loss in the beginnings when they show right, the veterans, but there's also a sense of comradeship with some of the guys that are featured. But I'm really looking forward to this one. You wanted to look at episode 9. Usually I get asked to comment on like Day of Days or the Crossroads episode, but I don't really get a lot of requests to talk about the Why We Fight episode. And I think this one's a fairly critical one because early, I mean, everybody knew the history by then, what was going on. But these guys are portraying fellows who didn't know what was going on, really. They just knew, as Rick Gomez's George Luz character says, the Germans are bad.
Yes. Well, no, he says it in a sarcastic way, so
He does, and that's what makes it more beautiful, the way he
Well, again,
says it.
Rick Gomez is great with the way that he plays Luz, even though after speaking to George, I know that some of it is a little exaggerated, but that's fine. It still keeps it fun watching him and seeing how how he portrays, I guess, the comedian, in a way for us to also relate better to the comedian, if that's the fact.
Without a doubt. But the interesting thing is all the veterans that I did talk about, and I didn't get to talk to George Sr. because he had passed before I became involved with the other veterans. But they all told me like George Sr. was the living, breathing morale of the company. And I think Rick really inhabited that throughout the miniseries.
True. Again, you see it. It's one of the things that I've talked about many times is the fact that there were so many easy veterans that when they were putting together this miniseries, they obviously couldn't focus on everybody. So there were people who were not either focused on or even mentioned that were part of it, which is why the book is a very handy companion piece. To be able to see certain things that happen in a way that they change sometimes the characters in order to be able to give us a character who we're more familiar with, even though they weren't really there.
Yes, without a doubt. There are some of the characters who are based on real people are doing things that other soldiers in the company had done, but you can't, as Eric Jendrenson, who is the lead writer and the executive producer, told me, you can't have 500 speaking roles. So they had to combine actions into characters. So that's an effective movie making in itself. It's not an attempt to be disingenuous or
No, not at all.
inaccurate. I mean,
Not at all.
as I've said many times when people ask me my opinion, it's not a documentary, it's entertainment.
Correct. Yeah. And also, even based on what you can read in the book and with the other story, with all the other biographies of the men of Easy, it could easily have made a few miniseries with completely different characters to be able to give us even more of a comprehensive look of it. But what they did with these 10 episodes is still amazing. To make us
Yes, and
feel
it and
as if we're right there with these guys, and even by now, when you're watching episode 9, episode 10, you care so much about these characters because they do
I
it.
think so, and I think that's why it's so very popular. Because, and I've recently completed a book, a first of 4 volumes about the company, and in it I said basically the miniseries and the book itself had helped to make these guys, who in our own minds are probably almost mythological beings in what they have accomplished. I mean, it made them human and approachable and personable. And I think that's part of the universal popularity of the
Exactly. I,
miniseries.
and again, I mean, we can even see how that affected all the actors. The fact that the actors and are still in touch with one another and routinely get together after 25 years is something unheard of in Hollywood. Hollywood's been around for, let's say, 120 years approximately, and there never was this type of thing where, 25 years later, people are still having reunions for a movie or TV show that they did. People would like for that to happen. But they themselves formed a bond over the 10 months that they were filming, that even that is somewhat unbreakable between them.
Yeah, without a doubt. I just got back from Toccoa, Georgia, actually last weekend, and we had two of the actors, Renee Moreno and Mark Lawrence. We also had Freddie Joe Farnsworth, who was one of the lead military trainer under Dale Dye.
Freddie's been on the show, and so was Renee. Yeah, I've talked to
Yeah,
both of them.
and Eric Jendrenson. So, and it was their bonds are as strong as they were the moment they got on set and started filming. It's really amazing to see them together.
No, completely. There's no question about that. And it's that's why it's also great talking to these guys, because you just hear in their voices, the how much they miss the other guys. And even when I've been, even when I talked with Bruce McKenna, and when I also spoke with Graham Yost, and even Eric Bork, they were saying that when they're doing other when they've done other projects afterwards, they've tried to seek out the actors that were part of Band of Brothers to continue with them to do things, because they had this bond and know what they can expect from them from an acting perspective also, which
And you have that symmetry with the real veterans too. So it's lovely the way it worked out.
No question about that. Very cool. So I just going back to the first comment that you made about sending a letter to Dick Winters, was his response helpful to you before going into battle?
It was interestingly, he basically you know, the thing about him is he doesn't stop being the major, right? To paraphrase the letter, it was some of it was kind of, I won't say personal, but from him to me. But there was one sequence in it where he wrote, "I don't sign books anymore because it's getting to be too much. But when you get home," and then in all capital letters he wrote, "and you will get home, send me your book and I'll sign it." And so, to me, he was still being the commander. You know, he had faith. He didn't know me from Adam. But I guess some of the things that I had written to him resonated. Mostly they had to do with about how he trained his men and cared for his men. I think it resonated with him, and he, like I said, he never stopped being the commander or the major, and he was basically telling me, just do what you're going to do, and you'll get home. And when you do, we can talk more. So it was, yes, and to carry that letter around in your rucksack, nestled in the pages of Band of Brothers, it was a pretty cool
Yes,
experience for
and
sure.
how long did it take after you got back stateside to go meet him to get him to sign it?
Well, see, that's the thing. I always respected his request for peace and quiet, and by then he'd been inundated with correspondence requests, appearance requests, and by then his wife Ethel was kind of putting the clamp down on people visiting. So I never wanted to intrude on his personal space. So I would we corresponded for a period of time, and then Ethel kind of very kindly said, "Please stop corresponding with Dick because he'll keep responding." And she wanted him to relax. And so I did, but Dick, being very cheeky, would send me notes every once in a while, or little comic strips from D-Day, with the Peanuts, with Snoopy, with the paratroopers and Ike. And he would write, "Look, they still remember us, even in cartoons." These very cheeky little notes that he would send me, which are great because I have these little stack of them. But yeah, he was just he Ethel was very much the commander of the house, but Dick was going to do what Dick wanted to do.
So you never met him in person from that perspective?
Never met him in person. Never met him in person. Actually, found out that he had passed when I was pulling a tour in Afghanistan, and got home. And a couple months later, we were at his memorial service in Hershey. So, never got a chance to, but I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of the man, and I think he had a pretty good understanding of me after the level of correspondence we
That's
had.
just amazing. That's something that you're really going to be able to take with you for very, very long time.
Yeah, it was tough to process it while I was in Afghanistan too. Just the caliber of human being that was no more there, no longer there, and I had no further option to communicate with. Again, somebody I greatly respected. It felt much the same way with Buck Compton when he passed. I was very, very close to Buck, and still remain close with his daughter Tracy and her husband, and the Compton family. And it is tough to lose them. Like I said, when I watch the episodes and the vets are speaking in the beginning, there's always a sense of loss because I knew most of them that appear. So it's very tough to watch that, but it is gratifying too because you
Exactly.
get to
There
see them and hear them
is
one more
that
time.
dichotomy of that, which that I mean that's
Yeah.
one of the things that I guess you can say we're all blessed with in this day and age, that things can be easily recorded on video for posterity. and you can go back and see things.
Yeah, and I think people tend to too many times take a binary view of your emotions. I think you
Yeah,
can
of
be
course.
sad and happy at the same
Of
time
course.
watching them.
And that's just really, really cool. Okay, so let's start talking about episode 114. So episode 114 begins with the poker game continuing.
I mean, even now in the military, cards are very important. It's a way to kill time. It's a way to socialize. It's a stress reliever. And if you notice, card playing in this series is a theme. You'll see it sprinkled throughout the miniseries. And much like that nowadays, or at least up until I retired in 2012, I'm assuming it's still remains the same. That cards is just that is very much a very socialized event. It's very much, again, a stress reliever. And again, it's great to see that in action, and also to see the frustration of the Nixon character. It predates the section where the segment we're watching, but Nixon had gone out and jumped with the 17th Airborne during Operation Varsity. He was an observer. His plane wasn't hit, although this is something that's a little off in the miniseries. It was actually the plane next to his. But you can't blame his observations because it may have looked like his plane as he exited. But in this case, the writers it got it close. And I always applaud them, especially because, again, Eric is a good friend of mine. They did a wonderful job in writing this, and humanizing all of it. And to see Nixon's frustrations, and grief processing and stress release, it falls back on the alcohol. But they continue going because back then, none of these guys were going to look at each other and go, "You feeling okay, man?" The closest you get to that is the
And
Winters
it's and I
sequence
mean
when he
when
talks to him.
it's a very short little conversation between the two of them also. And I mean I talked about this I believe yesterday, but
Yeah, and it kind of.
the idea that Winters is basically giving Nixon the same advice that Nixon gave Winters when he was writing up the report about how do you write something, just do it and that's it.
Yes,
I like the way
detached.
that they exactly. I like the way that they, jump back to that.
This is a credit to Major Winters, and obviously Eric had access to the major all the way all the way through the drafting of the series Bible, which was kind of the backbone, the framework of the series. It's like a reference manual, and then during the script drafting with the various screenwriters, they always had access to Winters, and they could literally call on him almost any time to have him fact checked, as Eric would say, the majors would say, make sure it's fact positive. In this case, in studying the major and getting and reading a lot of his written work, I noticed that, and this is a hallmark of a good combat leader, right? It's he is able to maintain investment in his men. But not so emotionally that he can't be objective during times where he may order them to the death. And this is reflected in that conversation. The Winters character, Damian Lewis, does a really good job of this. He's able to pull back from the emotion of the situation and say, "Hey, just do what we always do. You write home and you tell them that their
That's
guys
right.
are heroes." And it's really reflective of the real man. But to move forward, because I know we're kind of out of our segment right now, you see the Nixon functioning alcoholic here. And this was very true of him. And the interesting part about Nixon was that Winters said it himself, no matter, what his condition was, he was still an excellent combat officer and he had wonderful intuitiveness when it came to a battlefield. I think at one point he wrote, "Whenever we needed him, Nixon was there for us." Whether it's having the trucks ready for them as they're backing out of Neunen and in the Netherlands, or trooping the line in Bastogne in the Bois Jacques, Nix was always there for them. But he could do it as a functioning alcoholic. But we see the dependency in the next sequence as he's walking around trying to find essentially a liquor store that he can raid.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, there, you can go to any corner store and get a VET 69.
I mean, we'll get to that, right? A little further on
Yeah,
in the
exactly.
segments, but it's interesting as he's so despondent over what's happened, and he's so upset that he's out of liquor. He just grabs the gas can and throws it through the window with no regard to.
No, but that goes along with what everything is going on here anyway, with the way all of them are acting in this town. But
Yes, yeah,
you know.
and this is thematically consistent with how operations are conducted in Germany. And again, we're going to see this later in the segment. But you know, as he goes over to check in with the APO, which is the Army Postal System. Interestingly, I don't know how many fans you have of Ted Lasso. The mail clerk right here, Kieran O'Brien, plays Jamie Tart's father in Ted Lasso. Just an interesting bit. Very, very talented actor. Glad to see him here in these younger days. But it is very interesting that Nixon did indeed get notice of divorce from his ex. And it's funny how he reacts more emotionally about the loss of his dog
Yes.
than his wife. The funny thing was that Nixon actually, when they were stationed in England, had an English girlfriend. So it wasn't like he's being Mr. Faithful.
True. But again, he's gonna miss the dog. So
Yeah,
you can't
true.
blame him from that perspective.
Yeah. And you know, the scene goes on, and the Janovic character, Tom Hardy, a very young looking Tom Hardy, runs in and he announces the surrender of so many German troops, and that's true. And this is what kind of kick starts their movement deeper into Germany. It's kind of a race now.
That's right, between the Americans and the Russians. So who's gonna get there first?
Yeah, but also to affect the surrender of the German army units that are in front of them too. I mean, you want to put pressure on them to the point where they capitulate. You really, this far into the war, you really don't want to get into a shooting action if you don't have to. You're so close to the end, guys, they tend to be a little bit more careful. I saw this in my own experiences, but just a beautiful scene as it's filmed, showing off a lot of military hardware. But again, you have him finally blow up about the dog, and then and you have Donnie Wahlberg walk away, and you have Michael Fassbender telling everybody to load up. Yeah, it's a really beautifully set scene. Lots of great stuff in the background, such quality work to show off the equipment that these guys were carrying or riding in, and it's
Right.
really well done.
Sure. All right. So we're gonna back up a little bit. We're gonna go back to the card game. So
Okay.
these you know the officers are having their continue their poker game, and Lip starts with saying, "And I'll raise you another two." And then we see that Nixon just gets up, starts looking around,
Yeah,
you know,
he's got
trying to find something. Yeah.
zero interest in playing in this game anymore until he gets some more VAT 69.
That's it. Even though you can see in the background on the count on the I guess the dresser behind Lipton, there's like six or seven bottles of VAT 69, which I guess are all empty at this
And
point.
it looks like a bunch of beer bottles over near
Exactly.
near Spears. Yeah, I mean this far along, again, there wasn't the same strict rules about alcohol consumption back then there as there is today.
Right.
So these and again, that was considered a stress release. You know, if you look at the like officers of booze rationing, especially or rations, not rationing at that point in time, like every I forgot what the allotment was for every officer, especially from, you know, the battalion level and higher. It's really crazy to see that culture and how long the US military took to get away from it. But back in, this is the heyday of that.
And you know the guys around the table start talking as Nix is walking around, and Welch goes, "I can't believe we're not going to drop into Berlin." Beer goes, "No sh." Welch goes, "Ike's going to let the Ruskies have it." Ha, Ruskies.
Yeah.
And you know what's funny is that we are meant to focus on what's going on with Nix, and Nix just screamed out, "God damn it!" And the others are just pretty much trying to ignore him. Just let him. Okay, he's doing what he wants to do. Let's deal with this poker game. And he goes, "Let me tell you something. This war is not about fighting anymore. It's about who gets what,"
Yeah, there's a
which is a great line.
Yeah, there's and they're almost like throwaway lines because you're so concentrated on the Nixon actions here. Welshy's comments about not dropping into Berlin, because it makes it sound like he's kind of disappointed, but a lot of the guys that I talked to didn't want to. They didn't want to be part of varsity. They didn't want to jump into Berlin. They just wanted the war to be over so they could go home and go back to school or start families. And maybe that's because a lot of the guys near the end of the war here were replacements. There's very few Tacoma men still left in the ranks at that point. And I don't think there were too many guys who really did, especially the Tacoma men. They just wanted to go home. Not that they weren't great fighters, they really were. And they were well seasoned, but at the end of the day, it's a roll of the dice in combat,
Completely.
and these guys don't want to roll the dice anymore. And the Spears comment is really, I think, a hat tip to the real Ronald Spears, who ended up staying in the army for a long time, a long career, and ended up
He was a
being the
governor of
governor of
yeah.
Spandau Prison. So he
Exactly.
got to see a lot of the post-war Europe up close, and he's very correct in that it was about who owns what at the end of it. And it was interesting to read a lot of Eisenhower's papers and his thoughts about racing to Berlin, and when he finally decided the risk to my troops is not worth it, and you don't see that consideration on the side of the Russians.
Correct.
And so it's a very interesting, again, they're almost meant, I'm not going to say they're meant to be throwaway lines. There's not a lot of throwaway lines in this miniseries, but you get wrapped up in the Nixon piece of this, and you kind of just, they said it, and we move on to the next scene where he's throwing the gas can through the window.
That's right. And Nix at this point just says, why don't you deal me out of the hands? He goes, what
And
about
then
your money?
I was going to say, they start pilfering his money, right?
And then Nixon just leaves.
Well, he doesn't care. He's a well-to-do guy. I mean, he comes from a
Well,
family of
question
means,
is,
so.
do all of them know that? I don't know if they know that yet.
Oh,
I mean,
yes, they did. They do. That's the thing. Like,
because
very
we don't know
much.
about it. We don't know about it until the beginning of part 10. When
Well,
it's
that's in the
specified.
miniseries, correct, but in real
The
life, everybody knew it. Like, they knew he was an Ivy Leaguer. And there was a bit of competition at times between Nixon, Welsh, and to a lesser degree Compton, because Compton didn't really play those games, but for, I won't call it affection, but attention of Winters, because they were all friends with him. But I think that Winters gravitated to Compton because he was an athlete, gravitated to Nixon because they had basically gone through OCS together, and gravitated to Welsh because they were platoon leader and assistant platoon leader from about Camp McCall time in the United States all the way through the end of the war. So they were very close too. And it was kind of this unspoken competition, at least on the parts of the other two, not necessarily Compton, for that attention.
That's fair. And basically, they just give up and they say, "Are we going to wait on him again and let this
No,
happen?"
just steal his money.
And at this point, we see Nixon just trying to figure out what he needs to do. He goes out into the rain, doesn't care about the fact that it's raining. Lights up a cigarette and just starts walking around this town that they're in. And he comes across what looks like a drugstore and just looks at it and then just takes, I think, a garbage can, just throws it through the window.
He
Yeah.
grabs a gas can off the back of
Ah,
the
gas
Jeep
can.
and
Oh,
throws it
it's a
right
gas
through the
can.
window.
Gas can. Right. And I mean, we mentioned this before. It's funny that he thinks that he's going to be able to find some sort of booze, whether it's Vat 69 or something else, there.
Yeah, and
But
the funny part about that right after is the MPs show up, and he walks right past them. They have no idea that he's involved in it. They probably think he's just out for a stroll in the rain or whatever, and they completely ignore him.
that's right.
Because
And
the mentality is this captain's not going to do this. He's
that's right.
a captain, right?
But they you got to give them a lot of credit for their response time. They show up really quickly.
Yeah, without a doubt.
That's right. You have the German druggist shouting at him, and there's no alarm going off like it would today if that type of thing were to happen. And he
Right.
just walks out and goes, "Goddamn drugstore." And
Just
he
keeps on
walks.
tooling by.
That's right. Walks by the two walks by all the MPs that show up, and they basically say, "Sir, sir." And one of the guys just runs up to another one and goes, "Hey guys, wait up for me." And that's it. And then the shot changes, and it's now daytime, I guess, the following day. And once again, we see Nixon strolling through the town. And we have another throwaway line that there are three soldiers just carrying some supplies, and they go, "Hey Dexter, how you doing? Good to see you." Because you know who that was? He goes, "No." The question is he saying, that's Captain Nixon who just broke the window last night, or that's Captain Nixon and let's just stay away from him, that type of thing. Who
Yeah,
knows?
I would probably say it was the latter than
Yes,
the
probably.
former. But the hunt for Vet 69 has not ceased.
No, it has not. And also I love the fact that you see I guess some locals boarding up I guess the window that he just broke. So they I guess they got a little too much rain in the following night. And
Most
then
likely.
Nixon, that's right. Nixon goes across the street to the APO and meets up with Vest, as we talked about before, Kieran O'Brien. And he goes, "Morning." And he goes, "Captain Nixon, good to see you, sir." And he goes, "I think we had some mail for you." "Yeah, I'm gonna drop it off this after I was gonna drop it off this afternoon with all the other 2nd Battalion mail. But since you're here, yeah." And he gives it to him and goes, "Thanks. Listen,
Yeah, and he could care less.
I'm having some trouble finding some whiskey." Now, this I know you've told me before we started recording that you're not much of a movie fan, but have you seen The Shawshank Redemption?
I have not,
Okay.
sadly.
Okay. So this line reminds me of it because the idea behind Shawshank Redemption is one of the characters is the man who can get you anything you need, that type of thing. And that's more or less what Vest is here. Vest is the Red of Shawshank Redemption because he's, I'm having some trouble finding some whiskey. Whiskey? Yeah. A particular brand of whiskey. And he goes, then it's funny that Vest knows the answer to that. That's 69, which means that he is paying attention to what's going on and knows that 69 is what Nixon prefers.
Yeah, I mean, Vest is the fixer for in this scene.
Completely.
It's like he's already presaging exactly what's going to come out of his mouth about what kind of alcohol he wants.
That's
But
right.
I'm sure by that point in time, like everybody knows that Nixon's drink of choice is Vat 69, and Vest had been in the company for quite a long time, so he would have probably seen that at some point, that but it's good the way they set it up.
And then he goes, "Exactly right." He goes, "I gotta be honest with you, sir. That ain't gonna be easy to find here in Germany. Pickings are kind of slim here." He goes, "Yeah, don't I know it." And even if you do find some, sir, it ain't gonna be cheap. And because we know about Nixon, he goes, "Yeah, that won't be a problem."
Exactly. Yeah, it's a great little sequence there.
And then Janovic shows up and runs in out of breath. At least he's clothed this time. And he goes, "Hey Vest, you hear the news? Sorry, sir, I didn't realize you were here." He was a little surprised that Nixon has shown up there also. He goes, "What news?" He goes, "300,000 Krauts just surrendered." Vest goes, "300? Yeah, we're moving out in an hour." Nixon goes, "1 hour?" He goes, "Yeah, sir, your mail." And Nixon is trying to get out of there as quickly as possible. Now, what's funny is that this is the type of thing that Nixon should have known, since he is, he's been redemoted to being S3, so he should have this information, but
Yeah,
he doesn't.
he has bounced between operations officer, the S3, and the intelligence officer, the S2, between regiment and battalion. So you're generally going to have a good feel about what's going on, unless that information maybe just came over the radio or whatever. In which case, he's obviously hasn't been sitting by the radio. So it could have been a surprise for him. But generally, you kind of have an idea what's going on in either one of those shops.
Correct. So, it's a funny way to show us that right now it's more important for the S3 to find his VAT69 as opposed to trying to find knowing the information that 300,000 Germans are about to surrender.
Yeah, and the frustration keeps building, right? He's
That's
just, I
right.
can't find my booze. I start reading my letter.
That's right. And he just walks out of there with the letter and basically just tells Vest, keep looking.
Yeah, please do not stop that.
That's right. And we see that Nixon is continuing to read the letter as he's getting ready to get into the Jeep with everybody else ready to go. And excuse me, pardon me, get a move on it. Let's go. And we see a whole bunch of soldiers getting ready. And then Nixon goes, Jesus Christ, the dog? And Winters at this point just looks at him and goes, Lou? And Nixon goes, Kathy's divorcing me. He goes, I'm sorry. Taking everything. She's taking the house, taking the kid, taking the dog. It's not even her dog. It's my dog. She's taking my dog. And obviously we can see how upset Nixon is about the dog. As you mentioned earlier, he's more upset about the dog than he is about about the fact that that his wife is has decided to leave him at this point.
And hysterically watching Donnie Wahlberg as Lipton just turn his head and walk away. I always love that scene. He kind of looks up, he gives both of him and Winters a look, and then he just turns away and walks. He's like, I don't want to be part of this conversation.
And I mean, what's interesting is in the book itself, it doesn't mention anything about the divorce. Like, I couldn't find anything about the divorce in the book.
Yeah,
I don't remember mentioning it.
it wouldn't have been in there, but the thing is that again, the writers had Winters, and Nixon, if memory serves, it's been alive for the writing of the book.
He was alive for the writing of the book. He died in, I think, 96, if I
Yeah,
remember.
so I mean, all he had to do was ask Winters, and Winters, and they were close. I mean, he worked for Nixon after the war. It would have been very easy for them to get that kind of information from the major.
Right. The question is whether Winters would have remembered that it happened specifically, at this point, in time.
I mean, theatrically, it's a beautiful scene, but do
Oh,
we
for
know
sure.
that that's when exactly? I'd have to go back and look because the divorce records, if memory serves, are public here in the States, so it wouldn't be, I don't think it'd be terribly difficult to figure it out, but
No.
it
Honestly,
just
I
it's
don't
it
think.
fits nicely in here to watch the spiraling of Nixon. It's just a contributor in the scene. It's very well done.
Correct. And I mean, I like the added touch that we find out here that he has a kid even. I mean, up until now, you don't even know he's married or that he has a kid or the dog. None of
Yeah, and
those things are mentioned at any point before this, in the miniseries. This is
and in the
first indication.
right, and then the sequence, I believe it's before Bastogne, they blithely re mention he blithely mentions in a conversation that he's going to go back to England to meet up with his girlfriend. I think it's in the scene where Garnier returns to the company after being wounded in Holland. I mean, so they kind of they tease it out a little bit early on that he has a girlfriend, but you don't know anything else really about him. And then this, I guess all of it tends to be a surprise for the audience as you're watching it, and then it builds to almost hysterical levels watching his reaction about the dog and the throwing of the helmet, and Ron Livingston's like almost overacting it, but it's actually perfect the way he does it.
Completely. I love the way they do this.
Yeah, that's the one thing that the writers did a fantastic job in was adding levity into here. And I think that's something like in subsequent miniseries like The Pacific and Masters of the Air lacked a little bit of that levity in there, because having served for over 20 years, I mean, if I had a dollar every time there was something comedic that happened over the course of my time in service, I'd have a lot of dollars. It's just a key component. You need that as a way to reduce stress. And in this case, it's not. in that the character doesn't have any reduction in stress, but the audience gets it.
And I think that's one of the great things about this miniseries, the way they do it. They're definitely giving us a chance to see all the hardships that these are going through, but in order to make it through it, you need to also have moments of I don't know if sanity is the right word, but moments where again, these guys are all becoming really good friends, or they've become really good friends. Even when Nixon is frustrated about what's going on with his divorce, he's still able to find some way to keep it humorous, I guess you can say. And it makes sense. It
Yeah,
doesn't feel as if it's something that's coming out of left field.
you can't have heaviness all the time, and with a series like this where you have combat sequences, you have loss of characters, and you can't have heaviness all the time. And again, this goes back to the brilliance of the writers, being able to add these moments of levity in here to kind of keep the audience from shutting down. Again, brilliant, brilliant work.
Yeah, but I do agree with you that the Pacific and Masters of the Air are a little more dramatic, I guess you can say, and they tend to stay away from these type of moments. They do have them every so often, but it's I think that's partially due to the fact that the Pacific is meant to be more bleak because they want it to be they want us to really feel what the men went through there and how bad it was. Not that it wasn't bad in the European theater. But it was very different because there they were also dealing with the weather and they're dealing
The environment, yeah.
with the environment exactly. And here, let's put it this way: I still like Band of Brothers the best out of the three. But
I
I
am
do love
fond of
the other
all
two.
three. I'm fond of all three.
No,
Band probably
I
is my
love the other
favorite.
two. There's no question about that.
I love them all. I'm so happy that the companies that produce them were willing to stake that much capital on making these.
Yes, I agree.
And I hope they can continue to do so.
Yeah, I hope so too. I unfortunately with Masters of the Air because it took them so long to get that off the ground, pun intended. They weren't really able to get any interviews with some of the men. That was the thing that bothered me the most of Masters of the Air because you see it in Band of Brothers and also in the Pacific how helpful it is to hear the real men. Telling parts of their story, in the interview section.
I got to spend some time with some of the vets that were featured in the Pacific, and I was glad they were still around to provide their insights. And much like Ben, like you said, the veterans were still there. They were still vibrant too when they started the project. And my friend Leighton and I were talking about how you'll notice that the guys that had the most vibrant personalities had thicker storylines throughout the miniseries for the most part.
Again, because as you said, they're making an entertainment piece also here, not just telling us the history.
Yes, without a doubt.
Okay, and that makes sense. They want us to care about these characters. They want us to be able to differentiate between them also. I mean, again, the whole idea, and I'm trying to remember. I think it was Graham who told me this. That a lot of times they just had the actors in certain scenes without helmets so that you could tell them apart, not because that's what you would really do in that situation. And it's because they want us to say, oh, that's Garnier. Oh, that's Compton. That's as opposed to who's that guy with the helmet?
Yeah,
That
interestingly, Lipton wrote about that. There's one sequence at the end of the Foy episode after the assault, and the director wanted Donnie Wahlberg to take his helmet off to have this like hero shot. And Donnie basically called up Carwood Lipton and said, "Hey, would you ever take your helmet off during this?" He's like, "Hell no."
That's
He's
right.
like, "It's the area is still hot. You could get a piece of shrapnel in the head. There's no way you're telling you're taking your helmet off." And so Donnie fought to keep his helmet on. But it's interesting you talked about to have to take the helmet off so they can get a view of the faces. And a lot of times the actors were able to go back and BS check some of the scenes to enforce changes to their credit. And sometimes it had to do with them getting less screen time, and that is an unheard of in the movie making business. You don't want to reduce your screen time. You want more screen time.
And then the shot changes, and now we see the rest of the company starting to get ready for this for this move. And Christian's there and goes, "Let's go, load them up, on." And Sarge, what do we have in here? Germans? And then as they're getting all the gear together, getting setting up their guns on the way, it's done really, really well the way that they have them all move together. And then Spears calls out to Percante, and he goes, "Hey, Percante, you got a lighter?" And "No, sir, I don't smoke." He goes, "Hey, where are we heading?" He goes, "We're going to the Alps. Let me see that lighter." He goes, "The Alps? Yeah. That near Berlin, sir? No. That's in Bavaria. Birthplace of national socialism." And that was that. That's when Webster, just throws in. Webster's the educated guy, trying to give us the information, which we're gonna find out a little bit about it over the next. I think it's tomorrow. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit with Webster about that. But I love the way that this scene happens because, on the one hand, Spears is told by Pregante that he doesn't smoke, but he still has a lighter in order to give it to him. Because, a lighter can be very helpful to a soldier, even if you don't smoke. There are situations where having a lighter would be helpful. Not just to be able to light up with your friends,
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different things working in this scene that are have that are really, if you know what details to look for historically, there's some really great things here. Your comments about the lighter, definitely for sure. Sometimes you didn't have a flashlight; they used candles a lot at
Exactly.
times. Also, if you're going to light a time fuse for a demolition charge, you need a lighter. All those things are true. And then Spears' comment about fighting a guerrilla war, that was also very true. That was a propaganda minister Goebbels' attempts to prolong the war by slowing down the Allied advance because he was they were putting out this they called it the werewolves, which was basically it was going to be Germans that were going to be behind the lines that were going to conduct sabotage and such and guerrilla warfare tactics. And it never really came to fruition because I think one, the German troops that were around were being bottled up and forced to surrender. And two, the German people themselves are kind of tired of wars, being in combat since 1939. And then having basically the RAF Bomber Command and 8th Air Force just obliterating town after town after town, which we'll end up probably talking about at another point. These lines again, they seem like these little tossaways, but they're not. There's a lot of history baked into them, and they're really well done and nested into the scene.
Completely. And I mean, I also love the fact that that these characters are all having a conversation as this whole thing is going on. Like then Luz jumps in and goes, "That means they'll drop into Berlin." Sir, no drop into Berlin. Hitler ordered the Waffen-SS to hole up in the mountains and repel all the invaders. He wants them to start a guerrilla war. I wonder if they actually used the term guerrilla war at that time. Probably not.
I'd have to go
Because
back and look at the actual language. I know the term werewolves was used a number of times by the Nazi government in terms of trying to stoke this kind of thing, but I don't know if they actually used guerrilla war.
Yeah, I think guerrilla war started maybe in the 50s, right around Vietnam, when the French were in Vietnam and stuff like that. I don't know. And then Bull goes, "Invaders, damn, that's the sound of that."
The big country boy liked that one.
And then Spears goes, "They'll die trying to, they'll die to the last man trying."
Which is
And
funny because
Percanti,
they really didn't.
that's right. No, but that was what. That was the impression that everyone was given.
Yes, and that part of that is our own fault. When in the Casablanca conference, when FDR announced unconditional surrender, many of the commanders thought this would not. It left Germany no option but to keep fighting.
That's right. But again, once the head of the snake is cut off, you don't know how everyone else is going to react.
And
Exactly. they were wrong about that. And then Spear starts walking away, and Perconte calls him back and goes, "Sir," he goes, "What?" He goes, "My lighter." And
Yeah. Go
Spears
back
looks at
to
him and goes, "All right, nice lighter." And he tosses it back to him and goes, "Thanks."
the looting theme is still there.
That
Yeah.
is correct. Spears is, was making sure that he would have things to take home. And then Perconte looks over at O'Keefe and goes, "Waffen SS, huh? Hey, looks like they're gonna get your wish any looks like you're gonna get your wish anyway, O'Flannery. Those guys crazy." And he just mumbles under his breath, "It's O'Keefe."
Yeah, I never got a chance to talk to Patty O'Keefe to find out if any of these lines were true. He passed away, and frankly, I didn't really talk to Frank about this kind of stuff. We always just kind of got together and laughed. We talked about the mostly training. I asked him a lot of questions about Tekoa, but I never really asked him about some of this stuff. I asked him about D-Day, but late war is really tough. I really find best source for this kind of stuff. There are a number of guys who wrote very long journals, like Pat Christensen, Robert Rader, who wasn't featured in the miniseries, and frankly, it's a bit of a crime that he wasn't. And obviously, Webster's book, Parachute Infantry, is a very good documentation. But a number of the veterans took umbrage at some of the things that Webster wrote. So I don't know how to treat that at some point. You can verify things as a historian as best you can, but some of the stuff is probably lost in time.
And then the rest of this segment is basically the truck's moving out and everyone's singing Gory Gory. And we'll talk more about Gory Gory tomorrow. So Joe, did you have anything else you wanted to mention about this particular segment?
No, it's a great segment. It's got so much packed into it. I was really happy to sit there and kind of dissect it with you.
Yeah, me too. A lot of fun. All right, Joe, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yeah, actually, if you want, you can check me out on my podcast, the We're Not Lost Private podcast. Those of you Band of Brothers fan will recognize the line. We're on Patreon. You can find our podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Amazon, Apple Podcast, etc. We're all over the place wherever you find your pods. Look us up. We do topics other than Band of Brothers and Easy Company, but we do sprinkle that in there pretty liberally.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. Find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram, find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So until tomorrow, great.
Curry!